everyone, and welcome to another episode of Wisdom Chat. I'm your host, Phil Holdsworth of Aurum Gold, and my wonderful guest today is Sarah Buxton. Sarah is Senior Solicitor at Walker Foster Solicitors. Sarah, welcome to Wisdom Chat.
Hello, hi Phil. So I am a Senior Solicitor at Walker Foster, and I have been doing the job now since 2005, so a fair few years under the belt in terms of experience, specialising in helping people to resolve relationship breakdown, their financial resources as a result of that, and children matters. But also we cover sort of wealth protection, so looking after people who might be thinking of getting married and need a prenup or a postnup, or when people begin to cohabit together.
Thank you, Sarah.
We're a firm that's based mostly.
Yeah, go on.
Well, I was just thinking we're a firm based mostly in Yorkshire with lots of local market town practices. So we get all sorts of varied different examples and scenarios, and obviously live locally, so it's helpful if you know the local area.
Yeah, thank you, Sarah. Just for the sake of our listeners, just to say we do have a little bit of a time lag in terms of communication, so my apologies to our listeners if you're listening to this, but I urge you stay tuned, because what we're going to cover today is the whole area of divorce and its impact financially, and some of the implications that come from that. But what our intention is with Sarah and myself is to actually cover some other subjects. So listen out for further episodes where we're covering other related subjects to what we're covering today, and some of which Sarah's already touched on in her intro. So once again, Sarah, thank you very much for joining us. If I may open with, obviously, divorce in itself is quite a stressful time, and it may not be just the spur of the moment, most likely isn't. It's been building up, and people are emotionally charged in that period of time. What are some of the things that you're seeing when people come along and approach you for help through the divorce process? And what exactly are some of the things that are obstacles and challenges that you're facing when you're dealing with these clients?
So it is often very emotive, and as you say, emotionally charged. That first initial meeting with somebody probably lasts a good couple of hours, really, because you're covering quite a lot of bases and you're getting a feel for their own financial circumstances. I tend to find clients don't want you to talk about generically what can happen. They would rather know, when based against their actual circumstances, what is going to be the best advice for them. Initially, perhaps sort of either end of that meeting, there could be a good sort of 15 minutes either end where you're trying to get them to relax and feel that they can let you know where their head's at, basically. Sometimes they'll need coaching. There are divorce coaches out there that help clients who are going through the process and struggling in some ways, because it's an awful lot of change for a lot of people. We're trained, I am part of Resolution, which is a large community of family law professionals that really sign up to a code of practice to say, we will do this in the most non-confrontational approach that we can to try and take the heat out of it. And we're also trained as part of that and taught quite early on that there's usually somebody that's 6 months behind the decision-making process. So whilst both people in a relationship may realise that it isn't working, one perhaps always detonates for the other. And the person on the catch up, so to speak, is say 6 months or so behind. And it can often include a lot of change for them. So a change of house, a change of home, or in the longer term, the bigger change, you know, can we keep the matrimonial home where we've raised children, or do we have to face into it now needs to be sold? So we're just taught to be mindful of that initial meeting to try and let you get a feel for where the client's head is at. And as I say, for me, I find most people prefer it if you can talk in terms of their specifics. So telling them generically, you know, this is how the law applies to you, or this is what happens as a result of marital breakdown, doesn't always help somebody. It helps if you can say, here's your assets, here's how we move the pieces around the board, and here's some options, but nothing has to be made formal now and you don't have to act upon it.
I suppose change can be difficult for the best of us in many respects. When you know, I think back to my sort of over my working career and the times when we've gone through as a business, for example, through changes, and seeing how different colleagues have responded to those changes. Some quite embracing of them, quite, you know, sort of looking forward, looking to the future. And others who it's like a venture into the unknown. And I think when you talk about relationships as well, and in effect the breakdown of the relationship, I would imagine you're always going to get within that somebody who's really wanting to sort of cling on to the last vestiges of that relationship in the hope that something might happen and something might turn around. What are you seeing in terms of that period of time in the types of responses of people? Have you seen quite a mix of response? Do you ever see individuals who are quite happy to embrace it and move forward fairly quickly? Or do you see the other end of the spectrum or everything in between?
It feels like everything in between. And I suppose we just have to be mindful of how a client's gotten to that decision. Some will feel guilt, some will. Equally, I've had people that have astounded me because they've literally wanted to lance it like a boil. And I've been quite impressed by that in some respects. But you just have to touch in with them and make sure that they have gotten there for the right reasons. Especially because now lots of people are encouraged to try and sit around the coffee table or the kitchen table and try and come up with an arrangement that suits them, and then present that to said lawyers and say, look, this is what we think we can do. And we're happy to look at those options. It normally gives us an idea of where everybody's head is at. But it can't always be, it's not perhaps always achievable based in the law in the area, but you know, we can at least have a look at it. And then if a client says, well, this is what we would like to do as a family, we can look at it. Certainly down in London, there was a big push and a drive for what was known as nesting. So sometimes when the property is just too big and the children are based there and you can't really fund two families in London at London prices, one member of the setup, so mum or dad, or if it's a civil partnership or however the arrangement is in the relationship, but one parent will stay with the children 1 week, vacate on a weekend, and the following week is the other parent's turn. And so they'll rent out a small property, like a one bedroom bedsit, stay in that for alternate weeks, basically, so that the children have the least disruption. And that may well work as a holding position. Some families do it longer term. I think when new partners get involved or people start to move on in their lives, it probably hits a bit of a rocky patch and people need to start addressing, well, what are our options and where else can we go live? But at least that takes the pressure off. A lot of people, initially, it's what happens for the children and what's the impact for them.
Yeah, I was just thinking then, your response, there's so much in that, isn't there? You know, from the reasons why people have arrived at where they're at, And it could simply be that they just feel like they're going in different directions to other issues, like, for example, abuse, domestic abuse, economic abuse, things like that, and you know, two different sort of ends of a spectrum in a sense. So there are all manner of reasons why people come to that point, but also it's not just them, is it? It's the knock-on effect on other family members. And I can honestly say, having been through as a child, parents divorcing, from a child's perspective, it's quite unnerving. And yeah, it does have quite an impact on how a child might respond. And so it's not just how the parents might respond. And in that moment, emotions can be charged and decisions can be made emotionally rather than rationally. But also at the same time, there's that mindfulness of what do I do with the children and how do we keep them safe? And in some cases, some people are just so wrapped up in the situation that it's almost like that the children are peripheral. You know, they're not given as much, say, attention as perhaps they need in this rather unsettling time. Is that something that you see in terms of both the relationship, the reasons for them arriving at a divorce, to the knock-on effects on others around?
Definitely, the reasons. I mean, we often find addictions are included in reasons for marital breakdown. Sometimes it's just that people have been together a really long time, and to their credit, you know, after 23, 25 years, they've reached the end. Other people get a second spurt, some try counselling, some realise it's not for them. But, you know, alongside the coercive control or the domestic abuse, which we're all taught to be really mindful of and aware about, and that can be difficult to assess sometimes in that initial meeting. If a client doesn't realise they're going through it, it can be quite difficult to draw that out of them. But equally, addiction, you know, illnesses with alcohol or gambling, we come across all of that, and there's only so much one party in a relationship can keep taking. And as for the ripple effect, it isn't just your children, and they are definitely of paramount importance to the court and to the law, and certainly to most solicitors, it would be, you know, what's happening for the children is of paramount importance. But I think the ripple effect then leads to other family members, mums and dads, people that maybe sometimes you get big families that cohabit together, or you know, certainly around the area that we work, you know, Yorkshire, people buy big farms and have, or buy big plots of land and have family members living on the land. So, or in the local granny annex. So, you know, it can be really tricky. It isn't just mum and dad or the people in the relationship that you're separating. It can have a real ripple effect.
Yeah. Sarah, just to ask you, in your role, in your capacity then, how do you deal with those situations? Because I know your focus is very much on those that have approached you for help and advice, but how do you deal with that wider ripple effect?
You'd assess whether those involved would need to get their own representation, whether you can meet with them because that aligns with your client's agenda. If it doesn't, and sometimes even if it does, they're better off getting their own independent legal advice, and they're known as interveners if we then go down the route of any proceedings. They, you know, people that have contributed money to the property, or as I say, live on the land or on within the property, they have to have their own representation potentially. So the cost for everybody, I suppose, sadly, can begin to increase. But there are lots of other options that we would have to look at, certainly at that first meeting. As I say, it can be quite tricky because there's an awful lot that you're going over. You're not just assessing how have we gotten to this situation. We're then advising on the impact for children, advising on the impact of finances, any ripple effects, but also the different methods in which people can try and reach an agreement. There's lots of information out there, and we try and distill that into something that will be useful for them without bombarding them, but saying, you know, there's mediation, there's collaboration. We call it all different types of things. And within resolution, there's a real frustration that some of this terminology isn't easily understood for the for Joe public, and it isn't fair. So it's about sitting down and saying to them, you know, for a long time, mediation, clients would say to me, oh, is that about getting back together? And it's like, oh, no. It's about coming together with one advisor that's often a family solicitor trained as a mediator that only facilitates a conversation, really. But because they're from a family law background, they understand the type of conversation you need to be having. And so they'll be saying, give full and frank financial disclosure and let's talk about finances and move those pieces around the board. And what would you both like as an end result? And is that something that we can achieve based within what there is available? I suppose the hardest part is if you're having to manage people when they come in and the change is something, nobody really likes change. And as you touched upon earlier, even in industry, nobody likes change. And you have a full change director in some businesses, don't you? Their one job is to implement change. So it can be really difficult, I think, within a relationship when there's this huge disruption and change that's required. And we're, I suppose the hardest part is delivering the bad news to somebody to say, actually, what you want is millions away from where we can actually be, because there just simply isn't the money in the pot, or the debts are too high. Often people don't necessarily, because obviously sometimes money is a reason that people separate. And so it can be a really difficult, challenging conversation. But I find the best practice there is to break that news to somebody rather than trying to tell them, oh, it'll all be okay. You're better off sort of facing into it and saying, actually, I think the reality here is that you've not really got enough to go between you both, and we need to cut the cloth accordingly. So whilst you've not been doing it in the relationship, we need to now look to do it. It can be really hard for some people to hear.
There's a couple of things that I just want to touch on. Going back to what you, well, it's two things, the nesting and the children, and obviously I know they're interlinked. But in these, bringing people back down to earth, I suppose, and I don't mean that disrespectfully to anybody, but I mean in terms of some reality in a situation, because emotionally we can be catastrophizing, or we can be, you know, pressing for something that, you know, just isn't a reality in many respects. So when you're in your work, bringing those people back to that reality, with regards to children being involved, I mean, how do you go about doing that? And how does that sort of interlink with this nesting? I know you touched on it briefly, but just explain a little bit more about that.
So I think for lots of families, some, as you say, some people focus on the money because it gives them the control and the comfort that they need. Inevitably, most parents will say, now what do we do? And you either get a parent that has said, look, I've researched this, we've had the conversation and we're comfortable, we know what we're doing as far as the children are concerned. Or they say, I don't know what to do. And that can really vary on the age of the child as well. The advice that you would give would potentially be different. You know, a 16-year-old is very different to a 3-year-old, and their response and the way in which they handle divorce will be very different. We're lucky that resolution is a good source of information for lawyers as well as clients. And so it provides, there's a huge leaflet out there that we have lots of subcommittees really within resolution, and there's one for children, and they have produced a tremendous leaflet that sets out the different types of responses you get from children at different ages. As a general rule, this is what we have understood, and other professionals working with children will tell us. And then they give within the same leaflet the sort of the breakdown of how to expect your 18-year-old to respond to the news that actually mum and dad are no longer together, and what's the best way of explaining that to a child. And it's about giving them the reassurance at the time. And I suppose the older the child, trying not to use them as a crux for your own emotional support, and actually making sure you're giving them the support. So it's a really helpful leaflet. And everybody is different. Not all clients will want that pushed on them immediately. Some may just be getting the head around what's actually happening. They tend, hopefully, to resolve that quite quickly, how they're going to see the children. Because it's in, I think all parents pretty much understand that it's in a child's best interest to see and spend time with both the parents. The sad part is it is intertwined with money. So the child maintenance calculator comes up quite a bit if both parents work and one parent is the primary carer or the parent that has the residence of the children, i.e. they live with that particular parent. And it may only be that it's slightly more than the other parent. You know, if you split the week down the middle, it may be just one extra night, but it might tip it so that it's seen that they are the resident parent and the other parent is the non-resident parent, and all those labels begin to become frustrating, really, for a family when they're going through a separation. And if the family wanted to sit down and say, we're not having any of those labels, let's just agree a figure that everybody's comfortable with, that would be better.
Yeah.
But it isn't always achievable.
Yeah.
And everybody will come at that with their own agenda, I suppose, or their own thought process. But it so that can be quite difficult when you're discussing where children should be and for how long with which parent, because in the background will be this ticking along of, well, how does that impact how much I have to pay if you're the non-resident, or how does that impact how much I'll get? And actually, when you call it out and have that conversation, you often find the parent with care isn't actually that bothered as long as they get some contribution. And the parent without care and the one that they spend time with would actually say, oh, that's fine then, as long as we've agreed a figure.
Yeah.
Each family's different.
Yeah. And I suppose as well, when you're having those conversations, it kind of reveals where individuals are at, especially when we talk about children, because if the focus is more on the money, then you do kind of wonder, well, how much do you care for your children? How important are they in your life, if your focus is on the finances? I just think that, you know, it's a very, very, I take my hat off to you in the sense that it's a very difficult area. And again, you know, another area that's charged with huge emotions. And I just think of my own experience as a child growing up through both bereavement and then later on through divorce, and seeing that, you know, experiencing both as a child and the lack of consideration for a child. I was in that era when children are heard, not children are seen and not heard. That's it. Get my sayings right. So there was no thought of what must a child be going through. And that's interesting. You're talking about resolve. You've mentioned resolution a few times, and you've mentioned these leaflets that are available for people to help advise them on how best to handle things and children at different ages. I mean, how might a person be able to get hold of these leaflets? Where would be the best place to go to get that information?
The Resolution website, I think it's www.resolution.org. They have a whole plethora of information available, leaflets and guidance on probably all the technical jargon. I think in the leaflet I'm thinking of, there's a whole page dedicated to legal jargon. You know, you forget how much we think it's not jargon and that we've really tried to use the right words, but in reality, for Joe Bloggs that doesn't do this every day, when are you ever going to come across the word mediation or collaboration? And yet both are very two specific types of process that you can go through during a relationship breakdown to get yourself to an end result, basically, where you've got some form of a workable agreement. So yeah, it's important that people can access that information and do their own homework. And equally, a resolutions lister would be happy to sit and talk to them all day about it.
It's interesting what you're saying about jargon, because I do know it doesn't matter. It's not just in this field, but in any field where jargon's often used. But we don't actually stop a moment and think about how a person might feel when they're hearing certain words and use of jargon. And I suppose there'll be some things in the work that you do where individuals might feel, I didn't expect this. I wasn't going down that route. So there's a misunderstanding of what the jargon is actually referring to. So you mentioned mediation, and the immediate response is, oh, it's that, you know, to get us back together again. But also at the same time, when you're using other terminology that might make them feel like, insecure. They're probably already feeling secure in that situation, but it's interesting. In the world of training and development, we love acronyms, and I know that in the legal circles, you know, there's a lot of acronyms and terminology, jargon that's used, and we just take it for granted, don't we, that, you know, it's regular language to us. And yet we don't necessarily stop for a moment and think, I wonder what that person's thinking and how do they feel when I use that term? Now, I would imagine that you, because of the language that you're having to use, I would imagine you'll see an awful lot in that and different responses from people. What are the most common things that people tend to, I suppose, negatively respond to that you realise you've got to change or explain or something?
I think we always try to be mindful of it, but it's really easy to slip, I suppose. But we try and be mindful because, as I say, we're aware that it just isn't user friendly otherwise. I think for me, when you touch upon a resident and non-resident parent, the parent that is the non-resident, i.e. the child doesn't live, that can be a real source of insecurity, I guess, if that's the right, you know, just sheer frustration. They'll want to share parenting and co-parent. And so sometimes for some couples and families, it's better to call it a shared arrangement, that the child is, or the arrangements and respective children are shared. They're not just down to one parent taking precedent over the other, which may actually be very different to how it was in their relationship when they were together. You know, one may be the one that goes to work and the other stay home more. So naturally, the one that stays home more would be the one resident of the children and therefore knows all the routine, the schedule, what should be happening. It may be that on separation, the parent that was going out to work and being the main breadwinner says, actually, I'm changing the way I want to run things. You know, I want to be more hands-on. It can be quite a difficult thing for the parent that's home to hear that, because they think, well, you haven't done it all these years. Why are you suddenly doing it? But it's about having those conversations, I think, and calling one another out on whether there is an agenda in the background. But hopefully, it'll become quite apparent whether those conversations are going well or not. And hopefully, on the back of advice from solicitors, they would know how to phrase that and what to say, or in a process of counselling or mediation, it can come up where they say, well, this is, in an ideal world, what I like now that we're going down this route of separating.
You mentioned agendas. Just very quickly, do you often find people coming with their own agenda? And how do you identify the fact that there's another agenda going on in your conversations with them?
I think most clients coming in will want to know what's in their best interests. And then sometimes they'll have had conversations with friends or people at the pub or people at the tennis club that have said, oh, we think this and we think that, and this is what so-and-so did. And it's about saying, well, actually, that might have worked for them, but everybody's case goes on their own facts and their own family arrangements and how it's worked for you. So put all that to one side and let's focus on purely your own feelings. And in an ideal world, what would you like as an outcome? And that can range from, I just want it to carry on and for us to be better. At least you know where the client's coming from then. Yeah. And you know what type of help or therapy they may need on the periphery. Equally, they might say, do you know, I hope never to have to lay eyes on that person again. And sometimes you have to, sometimes a client will say to you, what about, you know, 5 years from now when we're at graduation for little Tom or we're at the wedding? And we're sometimes taught to remind somebody, what do you want? Not now, but 5 years from now, will you be bothered? You know, if we're £20,000 apart on a negotiation, in the grand scheme of things, is it that big a deal if it means that you can look one another in the eye at your daughter's wedding 10 years from now? You know, for lots of people, it's about getting to that place. And it's a journey. It doesn't just happen overnight.
Yeah. I'm just thinking of other aspects that come to play in a situation like this. And we've touched on it occasionally throughout the conversation. That's finance. And, you know, and often where we say, I mean, from the sort of money debt advice world, we often refer to the fact that, you know, one in four relationships break down because of money conflict. So it does have quite a sizable impact on finances, and finances have quite a sizable impact on relationships. What are you seeing at the moment? What are the things that are coming across to you in terms of these circumstances?
So at the moment, given how interest rates are, people are arguing about who can port the mortgage or keep hold of the mortgage. And I don't blame them. You know, if you've managed to secure yourself a really good mortgage rate, but then trying to quantify what that is within a relationship to the party losing out can be quite difficult. So there's that element of things. I suppose for us, it's about trying to get to the bottom of what it was like in the relationship. If you both, I mean, it rarely happens, but if you both had equal responsibility and equal understanding around the financial arrangements, and joint accounts were genuinely accessed by both parties. Sometimes you find they don't have any joint accounts. Sometimes you find that the joint account isn't really accessed by one party. It's mostly the other party does all the manoeuvring and paying of the bills. It can be very easy, can't it, depending on what your personality is like, whether you want to engage in financial responsibility and decisions or whether that's left to somebody else in the relationship. It can vary. And it's about trying to understand how that was in the relationship, because that then will normally feed into their insecurities then about, will they feel comfortable going and having a conversation about finances? Do they feel that they are ready and able to know what it is they want their future to look like? And it can vary, because often most people now go out to work and earn well, and or it's acknowledged that they might work part-time, but they're giving in other ways because actually sending the children to full-time care would be too expensive. That said, if you've got sort of a director of a business divorcing someone that is stay-at-home parent, that person that's staying at home may feel really out of the depth then, having to, you know, you often get people saying, but they will be better at the conversation with the solicitor. They're not going to be intimidated the same way I am. So it's about a client feeling that they can tell you that, A, this is how I'm feeling, this is what I'm thinking. And sometimes just asking them outright and saying, you know, how has it been in the relationship? How would you feel if you had to sit down and have a conversation? And they'll often be very clear with you. And then you can guide them down the right route for them. And so, well, actually, if you had me in the background helping you, would you be okay with mediation? Or do you think if we can't come to an agreement, what about solicitors sit round a table with you both and we try and reach an agreement?
Yeah. I think it's a difficult one, isn't it? Because I'm so familiar with where relationships have hit that rocky period, and there's that sort of conversation about separation and so on. And having seen it in some friends, where one party has not really dealt with the finances, and all of a sudden now they're expecting no one understand what they need to do, and they're panicking because they realize they don't. And so there's that sort of burying the head in the sand, or that sort of outward panicking, which we could, that you can pick up, can't you? And you can tell somebody's really stressed and anxious about a situation because of how am I going to deal with the finance side. How do you help people like that? How do you sort of reassure them, I suppose?
So often you tell a client to bring a friend with them to the initial meeting because they have two people taking note, and you can bombard them, I suppose, with information. So at least they can go away and deconstruct that with the friend that they brought with them. The friend might be able to, when they're not in the storm, be able to see things slightly differently. Talking to a client, reassuring them to go and get the advice that they need. Sometimes that's debt advice, sometimes that is advice from a financial advisor. I mean, some of the bigger cases where there's lots of wealth sloshing around, one of the parties to that may say, I'm just really concerned once I've given all this money, what are they going to go do with it? And part of actually reassuring that person might be to say, it's okay, we're going to send this person, the other person, off to get some advice around how much it will cost to live and where they how they should budget each month, because a financial advisor will help them and it's a trusted person. And you know, some husbands and wives go to the same financial advisor or make sure that they're content with the other's financial advisor just so that they know that they're in the right hands and that they're being taken care of. Because I suppose the biggest fear is, well, what if they just go and spend it all? And people do try and then dictate what should happen later down the line. Well, I don't want so and so to remarry and for that new person to go. Well, okay, well, let's look at whether we can have some confirmation that they'll make sure it is passed on under a will or that it is ring-fenced in some way later down the line.
Yeah, I know
It's about working out what everybody's.
Yes, yeah, exactly. And I know in my own family experience, and not necessarily in terms of divorce, but certainly an individual left having to now deal with the finances who didn't deal with the finances before. They just left it to their partner, and very trusting in that sense. And also their own belief that they were no good with money, that they weren't very good at maths, and therefore and their partner is, and so I'll leave it to them. And all of a sudden now being faced with it, I mean, we've had situations where an individual has immediately thought, what am I going to do? I've got no money left, I'm poor. And actually, once they've received help, have suddenly found, well, you're not that poor. In fact, you're quite well off, but had no idea, because they just weren't involved in it. And I suppose as well, the other side is for an individual, and you mentioned the debt advice side, but also the money advice, which doesn't necessarily have to be debt, can be simply, well, this is what you're entitled to in terms of like benefits. You mentioned the child maintenance calculator. So I know there are organizations around that give really good advice around those things. That I suppose the challenge, isn't it? And I've seen this again as well, and that is where children are involved, and you're talking about sort of maintenance, where you've got a reluctant partner in this breakdown of relationships who just avoids wanting to sort of contribute anything. Now that must be quite challenging. I mean, from a legal point of view, how do you sort of deal with that? And even beyond that, what advice would you give to people who find themselves in a position where they're looking after the children, but they're receiving nothing for that, including civil partnerships as well?
Yes, yeah, it depends whether they are in employment or not. If they're employed, then the Child Maintenance Service has quite a breadth of power available to it, and keep persevering. It's frustrating. It's a government-run body and has all the foibles that come with that. But keep going, because they will get there. If your solicitors know fairly early on that they think they've got someone that is going to be evasive to committing to a long-term financial contribution for a child, they'll look at whether there's any scope to firm that up, basically, quite early on. And whether that's, I suppose, some people can fix it if they run their own businesses, that they get paid a particular amount. But again, the Child Maintenance Service does have the ability to really drone down into that. It just takes time. But equally, your solicitors can also look at it and use it as part of the arguments for how to come away from equal arms as a result of marital breakdown. You know, generally, can we look at the equality there, and is there equality? You know, reasons to depart from equality based on needs. And nine times out of ten, if we can run it, we will run it based on needs.
Yeah. Sarah, that I mean, this is really interesting, and I'm sure very, very helpful for people listening to this. And my statement to people listening is, if any of this resonates with you, and you're kind of wondering your own circumstances, what could you do? There is an awful lot of help and support, not just, you know, firms like Sarah's firm, Walker Foster, but also, you know, organisations such as the Money and Debt Advice World that can also help and support. And you're right, Sarah, about, you know, the child maintenance side. They do carry an awful lot of sway and an awful lot of power, but equally, they are a government department, and there's an awful lot of like delays and bureaucracy. And you're right to say, you know, just don't give up, persevere, because, you know, at the end of the day, it's important that people are supported through these difficult times and are able to receive what they need to be able to support them through the next phase of their life. So just to say, Sarah, in terms of somebody who has been touched by this podcast and would like to talk to somebody, how could they speak to you? How could they get hold of you?
So we have direct dials available on the website, as far as I can recall, or drop me an email, basically, scb@walkerfoster.com. I think if people are really in urgent need, then by all means give us a call, but a quick email to scb@walkerfoster.com.
Okay, that's scb@walkerfoster.com. Thank you very much, Sarah. Again, for our listeners, and correct me if I'm wrong on this, Sarah, but we're gonna pick up on some of the other issues around relationships, both in terms of people considering marriage but have concerns, you know, what people can do, what can be done to sort of put things in place. We're going to sort of cover that in another episode, but just as a taster, just let people know what our thinking is with regards to, like, for example, pre and post nuptials.
Certainly. Yeah, I think for a lot of people, pre and post nuptials, they're not sure that they are sound or worthy, and or whether they're for rich and famous people. And all of those are myths. They are sound and worthy. They're worth having. They do get upheld regularly by the courts. And I'll go into that in more detail on the next discussion. They're not, you know, per se binding, but the court will consider them, and as I say, regularly say, no, we'll stick with this one, thanks. And then that's pre and post nup. But also, families come in all different shapes and sizes these days, and for a lot of people, they don't get married, but they can live and cohabit for years and years. You know, I've got lots of examples of people that cohabit, and we probably need to look at that as well in terms of what people's rights are, because I think for a lot of people, it's dispelling this myth that there is a common law husband and wife, that there isn't one. So if you only cohabit, it's very different to being married, in the eyes of the law, and what you're then entitled to. There is a big drive to try and change that and get some protection in place for families that just don't either believe in marriage or have the time or inclination, to go ahead and get that piece of paper, or the civil partnership. So it's about looking at the different types of families and then the impact of, finances for them, but also pre and post nup and how you can protect, or not so much just looking to protect, but to try and take out the sting of, separating, how you can do it more amicably, I suppose, if you know what you're going into at the outset. Marriage is a contract at the end of the day. So going into it open-minded and clear boundaries as to what the likely outcome would be if you separated, then that's helpful for everybody, really.
That's wonderful. Thank you so much, Sarah. Really appreciate your time. And I look forward to chatting with you again on those latter issues that you've just told us all about. So thank you very much, Sarah.
Lovely. Thank you. Thanks, Bill. Take
It's a
care.
pleasure.
Bye.
Bye.